Good morning, PGC. This morning, I've got a special request from the church leadership to speak on Daniel chapter 3. At the same time, I've also started a mini-series of my own on church and missions history. So we'll try to blend the two together and see how it goes. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Biblical names that you're probably familiar with if you grew up in Sunday school and if you were paying attention. But do you know how much you have in common with these people? I can think of at least two things. Most of you have two names, a Chinese one and an English one. They did too. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these were their Babylonian names. Their Hebrew names were actually Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But there is one important difference. Your Chinese and English names probably pose no ideological conflicts to each other. Whereas for them, the L in the original name Mishael points to Elohim. The Yah in Hananiah and Azariah actually points to Yahweh. These were violently snatched away and replaced with axe and bells when the names were changed. And the axe and bells, they point to the Babylonian gods. There goes the respect for the Hebrew God that was embedded in their original Hebrew names. That's number one. Number two, they were schooled in Babylonian literature. And Babylon has come to be synonymous with the entire worldly system that sets itself up against Judeo-Christian values. You too were born into an anti-Christian time, where Judeo-Christian values and beliefs are constantly under attack and increasingly being squeezed out of our culture and ethos. Like you, they were ordinary people who found themselves in extraordinary times. They couldn't go back and change the beginning, but they could start where they were and change the ending. And that they did. And they became ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives, little giants of their times. What about you? The story started when this King Nebuchadnezzar got carried away by his soft power. He decided to become a wolf warrior. He built for himself a larger-than-life statue, and he decreed that all must bow down and worship this thing. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they said a definitive no. They were determined to never bend the knee to any gods other than the true God, Yahweh. They knew what they were getting themselves into. They've calculated the cost. Notice what they said in chapter 3, verses 17 to 18. They said, if this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. They were fully prepared to pay the ultimate cost. The king, of course, blew his top. He decided to give the three of them a nice cremation, a life. And so he had the strongest of his men tie them up and toss them into the fiery furnace. And to make sure that the cremation is well done and not rare or medium rare, he ordered that the heat be cranked up 7 times higher than normal, which probably doesn't mean changing the temperature setting from 100 degree to a 700 degree. After all, they're not roasting turkeys. It probably means turning up the heat as high as it can be, which is how the number 7 would be used figuratively in those days. The furnace was so hot that even the men who were charged to toss the 3 into the furnace were killed by the heat. King Nebuchadnezzar sat at a distance, watching the show. "But look, the 3 were having a party in the fire. There was even a 4th person with them." Well, some believe now that this is the pre-incarnate Christ. Utterly amazed, he invited the 3 to come out from the fire. And so they came out, not a bit hurt. They didn't even smell Korean barbecue. "So what is this? Some kind of smokeless grill?" And the king had to eat humble pie and decree that no one should speak against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego without facing a horrendous death. Powerful reversals. In just one chapter. At the beginning, this power intoxicated king, who thought he was bigger than the Hebrew God himself, ordered that everyone bow down before the statue. At the end of the chapter, this king was humbled and crumbled in the knowledge that this God is much, much bigger than he is. Those who obey the king's orders, the man who tossed the 3 into the fire, they were killed. Those who defy the king's order, the 3 who were tossed into the fire, they were miraculously saved and even got a promotion at the end. The gods that the king was trying to exalt were humiliated. And the Hebrew God that he was trying to humiliate was exalted. What Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did was alluded to in that famous Hall of Fame passage in Hebrews 11. It talks about those who quenched the power of fire in verse 34. They are part of the cloud of witnesses that's referred to in the chapter immediately after that. They belong to the same line of saints of God throughout the ages. People who treasure heaven more than earth. People who have chosen to put their heads on the block and their comfort and well-being on the line in order to serve the eternal God. They were not the first ones. It would certainly not be the last. At this point, I would like to shift the gear a little and show the first part of a 2-part video clip on church and missions history. One of the reasons why I'm doing this, as I said before, is that I'd like to develop a mini-series on church history, something I feel that Chinese and even non-Chinese churches have not been teaching enough on. There is so much to learn from history. The other reason, and the main one for the purpose of this message, is that as we watch the clip, we will see more Shadrachs, Meshachs, and Abednegos throughout history. More of these little giants. The clips were first shown in the Song Conference 2010. It's a worldwide missions conference. It's a worldwide missions conference, and that took place in Cape Town, Africa. That's why you will hear a beautiful African accent in the narration. and joy.
How did a persecuted movement that began with a small group of Jews who believed that Jesus was the Messiah become the most widespread religious movement in the world today? The history of Christianity is uneven and filled with tragedy. Persecution, disease, and war threatened it from without. Heresy, corruption, and schism endangered it from within. Yet no matter how many setbacks and seeming defeats the church has suffered, Jesus has and continues to fulfill his promise that he will build his church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Before his ascension, Jesus left his disciples with a commission and a promise. A commission to spread the good news about him to every ethnic group, tribe, and language. And a promise that they would not be alone. He would send the Holy Spirit to help them, to be with them, and to be in them. The day of Pentecost is often considered the birthday of the Christian church. At the time, there were approximately 200 million people on earth, 60 million under Roman domination. Yet the faith of a small handful of Jewish believers would, over the next 300 years, grow to become the most popular and ultimately official state religion of the Roman Empire. One of the most important events after Pentecost was the conversion of a strident enemy of the faith, Saul of Tarsus, who became the Apostle Paul, the forerunner of all Christian missionaries, and the author of at least one-third of the New Testament. Paul was executed by Rome in 64 or 65 AD. His death coincided with the next major turning point in the life of the young church, the Jewish Revolt. The pinnacle of the conflict was Titus's siege of Jerusalem in 70, in which, according to Roman historian Josephus, 1.1 million perished. The revolt was an unmitigated disaster for Judaism, bringing an end to the sacrificial system, driving the Jews from their homeland. The Romans renamed the land Palestine, their version of the word Philistine, Israel's ancient enemy. The effect on Christianity was also profound, since Rome now made it illegal to become a Christian. Many Christians were certain it was the end of the world. But more than any one event, the Jewish revolt forced Christianity outward. Rome tried again and again to stamp the faith out. Initially, persecution was not widespread, but localized, focused on certain areas or individuals. Nor were Christians always sought out for punishment, but when they were caught, their executions were public, barbaric, and savage. But for early church leaders, the greatest threat came from within. False prophets made claims contradictory to the apostles' teaching. Counterfeit gospels appeared. Heresy forced Christians to articulate clearly what they believed, resulting in a number of creeds. Heresy also played a role in finalizing the canon of Scripture. As Christian numbers grew, so did Rome's animosity toward them. In 250 AD, Rome called for house-to-house raids in the first empire-wide persecution. Believers who refused to denounce Jesus were tortured and killed. In 303, the Emperor Diocletian sought to systematically cleanse the empire of Christianity once and for all, a monumental task as believers now made up 10 to 20% of the population. It would be the final imperial persecution and the most terrifying. After Diocletian's death, the Emperor Galerius, on his deathbed, called for an end to the killing. Few would have dreamed that the next Roman emperor would become a Christian. In 312, on the eve of a great battle, Constantine had a vision. In the sky he saw this symbol, the first two letters of the Greek word for Christ. He heard a voice say, "By this sign you shall conquer." The next day he won the battle decisively. For Constantine, whose mother Helena had been a believer, it was sure proof that the Christian God was the true God. His conversion would change Christianity forever. Constantine restored confiscated property, gave Christians special privileges, built basilicas, promoted Christians to high office, granted clergy tax exemption. Constantine established Byzantium, modern-day Istanbul, as the new headquarters of the Roman Empire, renaming it Constantinople. Under Constantine's influence, the liturgy adopted a formal, court-like quality, borrowing many pagan practices. One of his more enduring legacies was his call for the first ecumenical or worldwide council. The Council of Nicaea set a precedent for how orthodoxy, meaning right teaching, would be determined. It also produced the first draft of the Nicene Creed. Constantine may have granted Christianity favor, but it was Emperor Theodosius who made it the official state religion. For three centuries, Christianity had been persecuted. In the fourth century, it had been liberated, empowered, and transformed. In the fifth century, the unthinkable happened. Rome fell to the barbarians. Most people were certain it was the end of the world. Within 100 years, the western half of Europe was unrecognizable. The once powerful, unified Roman Empire was now a chaotic smattering of smaller, tribal kingdoms constantly at war with each other. To add to the confusion, many barbarians had been converted to the Arian version of Christianity, which denied Christ's divinity. Their influence diluted the Christian message, but not everywhere. While Rome was collapsing, a former English slave named Patrick returned to the land of his captors and proclaimed the love of Jesus, and Celtic Christianity was thus founded. The change was so profound, Ireland became a launching pad for sending missionaries throughout Europe. In 316, two young Christians were shipwrecked in the Red Sea. They were taken as slaves to Ethiopia to serve in the royal court. They were allowed to preach the gospel, and their witness gave birth to the church in Ethiopia. Syrian missionaries, who had carried the gospel to Ethiopia in the 3rd and 4th centuries, now followed long-established trade routes to southern India. They founded native Christian communities that claimed their origins traced back to St. Thomas himself. The eastern, Greek-speaking half of the Roman Empire did not fall to the barbarians and would remain for 1,000 years. It became the Byzantine Empire. Here the emperor was strong and the bishop subservient. The emperor imposed his will on the church. In the west, it was just the opposite. The emperor was now weakened and the bishop became strong. This gave rise to the papacy of the Middle Ages. Leo the Great was the first bishop of Rome to claim total authority over the whole or universal church, Catholic meaning universal. He employed an argument already advanced by previous bishops. Jesus made Peter the rock on which he would build his church, and since Peter died in Rome, the bishop of Rome was therefore his direct successor. There were five sees at the time, that is, a city with a bishop overseeing a large area. The eastern bishops rejected Leo's claim. The center of Christian gravity remained firmly in the east. At the same time, a number of theological controversies surrounding the nature of Christ threatened to tear the church apart. Councils were called to resolve the disputes, but their rulings did not result in the desired unity. The Nestorian and Monophysite Christians were deemed heretics and split away from the church. Meanwhile, the Western Church struggled to create order out of chaos. A devout Italian monk named Benedict wrote his rule, which became the standard for monasteries throughout the Middle Ages. Monasteries preserved the gospel during the church's darkest days. The church saw its most pure-hearted pope at this time with Gregory the Great. He wrote volumes on Christianity and is considered one of the four great Latin doctors, along with Jerome, Ambrose, and Augustine. After seeing blonde-haired Anglo slaves in a Roman slave market, he sent missionaries to their homeland to preach the gospel, the first step on the long road to the conversion of what is today England. With the West in turmoil and the East entangled in theological disputes, neither was prepared for the latest threat that was about to overtake them. In the 7th century, Islam roared out of the Arabian Peninsula with lightning speed. City after city fell to Muslim control. Three of the four sees in the East were now in Muslim hands, leaving Constantinople the lone city overseeing the Greek-speaking church. Islam's stunning success was due to a number of factors, but divisions within Christianity had weakened the church, making those areas vulnerable to attack. Islam made the dire situation in the West even worse. The barbarians had left Europe with no government, no army, no education, no law enforcement. Now, trade routes were cut off, currency dried up, land became the only thing of value. This gave rise to feudalism, a kind of caste system revolving around land, which created extremes of wealth and poverty and led to a perpetual state of war. Most people were certain it was the end of the world. Beyond the Muslim world, Nestorian Christians carried the gospel along the Silk Road, deep into Central Asia and China. In 635, they were welcomed at the imperial court in China's capital city of Chang'an, the largest city in the world at the time. The Nestorian church enjoyed 200 years of success until they were wiped out in a wave of persecution in the 10th century. Thus, Christianity has been in China for as long as Buddhism has been in Japan.
Feeling overwhelmed? This is just part one of two. If you find it too unwieldy to handle, perhaps you'll find this helpful. A missiologist by the name of Ralph Winter, he helped us to see Old Testament and New Testament history in 10 epochs. Now, for the purpose of this message, we'll only be looking at the two epochs after the cross, which is epoch number 6 and epoch number 7, which we will call period 1 and period 2. Hopefully, as my series go on, we'll have more opportunities to look at the other epochs. Period 1. At first glance, it would appear that the major turning point is the Christianization of the Roman Empire that started with Constantine and was consolidated by Theodosius. Indeed, Proverbs 21:1 says, "The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever it will." But if you look closer, it's actually the diaspora Jews and the God-fearers who were the steel rails on which the Christian movement expanded. The gospel spread through an unplanned process. Friends, relatives, and trade contacts, they took the gospel wherever they went. They were doing what we would call today a tent makers ministry or marketplace ministry. They were so effective, so successful, that by the year 312 AD, there were enough Christians in the Roman Empire to make an official reversal of their anti-Christian stand not only feasible, but also politically wise. So even if Constantine had not become a Christian, the empire would not have held out against Christianity for another 10 or 20 years. How did that happen? I would invite you to listen to a second century document that describes Christians. It's known as the Epistle of Methodius to Dionysius. I will read it to you. Close your eyes and listen if you want. Here's how that document describes the Christians. "Christians are not distinguished from other men by country, language, nor by the customs which they observe. They do not inhabit cities of their own, use a particular way of speaking, nor lead a life marked out by any curiosity. The course of conduct they follow has not been devised by the speculation and deliberation of inquisitive men. They do not, like some, proclaim themselves the advocates of merely human doctrines. Instead, they inhabit both Greek and barbarian cities, however things have fallen to each of them. And it's while following the customs of the natives in clothing, food, and the rest of the ordinary life that they display to us their wonderful and admittedly striking way of life. They live in their own countries, but they do so as those who are just passing by. As citizens, they participate in everything with others, yet they endure everything as if they were foreigners. Every foreign land is like their homeland to them, and every land of their birth is like a land of strangers. They marry like everyone else, and they have children, but they do not destroy their offspring. They share a common table, but not a common bed. They exist in the flesh, but they do not live by the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but they are citizens of heaven. They obey the prescribed laws, all the while surpassing the laws by their lives. They love all men and are persecuted by all. They are unknown and condemned. They are put to death and restored to life. They are poor, yet make many rich. They lack everything, yet they overflow in everything. They are dishonored, and yet in their very dishonor, they are glorified. They are spoken ill of, and yet are satisfied. They are reviled, but blessed. They are insulted, and repay the insult with honor. They do good, yet are punished as evildoers. And when punished, they rejoice as if raised from the dead. They are assailed by the Jews as barbarians. They are persecuted by the Greeks, yet those who hate them are unable to give any reason for their hatred. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these are ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives. These are little giants of their times. And that takes us to period two. During this period, Charlemagne, or Charles the Great, instituted a series of Christian reforms. He was piggybacking on the strong monastic system that had been built at the time. But eventually, Rome lost half of its empire, the western part, which is Italy, Spain, and North Africa today, to the barbarians. But the barbarian world gained the Christian faith from them. And it's against the backdrop of these dark and chaotic times that we see two saints of God. They are also among those in the cloud of witnesses. Patrick, notice the green that he's wearing? What does that remind you of? St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, this is the Patrick that the St. Patrick's Day remembers. So it's got absolutely nothing to do with green beers. When he was about 16, he was captured by Irish pirates from his home in Britain. He was taken as a slave to Ireland. While there, he was looking after animals. He lived there for 6 years. And then he escaped and returned to his family. Shortly after, he became a cleric. He made a bold decision. He decided to return to the land of his former captivity. So he returned to Northern and Western Ireland. In later life, he served as a bishop. And by the 7th century, he had already come to be revered as the patron saint of Ireland. And then we have Boniface. Looking at this picture, what strikes you almost literally? The axe, right? Well, that's his ministry tool. He would use that to axe down supposedly sacred trees and idols. And he would declare that the Hebrew God, the God that he believes in, is more powerful than any other gods. And then we have Alope. This is the guy who took Christianity to China for the very first time. And that was in the 600s. What you're looking at is the Nestorian stele. I had the privilege to see this with my very own eyes when I visited that part of the country about 10 years ago. But who's Alopen? Well, he was a Nestorian monk, and he was persecuted, and so he left and fled to China. Again, ordinary people living in extraordinary times and living out an extraordinary life. These are the people who have gone on before us. They are the Shadrachs, the Meshach, and the Abednegos of their times. They have now joined the cloud of witnesses. They have joined that long line of the saints of God. And you and I are called to join that line as well. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were remnants living in exile. But what they did brought to generations of readers hope and encouragement while living under oppression. They were history makers. They were world changers. Like them, you are also like remnants living in exile time during these anti-Christian times. And by what you do, you can point those around you to the ultimate hope and freedom that can only be found in Christ. You can also be history makers and world changers. As a matter of fact, you are called to be that. History makers and world changers. 1 Peter 2:9 says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." You are ordinary people living in extraordinary times and even hostile times. You cannot go back and change the beginning. But you can start where you are and change the ending. Something you may or may not have known. The book of Daniel was mostly written in Hebrew. But starting from chapter 2, verse 4, all the way to chapter 7, 28, the book made a switch to Aramaic. Why Aramaic? Because it was the language used across the world for diplomacy and commerce at the time. So it's the language that's known to everybody, even the non-believing world. So it's like you want to make sure that your Chinese-speaking mom and dad understands what you want to say. And so you switch to Cantonese or Mandarin. God inspired this part of the book of Daniel to be written in Aramaic for that reason. He wants to make sure that the non-believing nations can see how his people live and shine, even in a hostile world. And that's what you and I, as ordinary people, are called to do during these extraordinary times. May the Lord help us to do that.